Hi, I'm Sahel Janissari, migration researcher and activist. I'm very, very lucky to be able to present to you the Qualitative Applied Health Research Center's Qualitative Open Mic podcast. And this series is all about interpretation.
In this episode, we have a real privilege of hearing from Elaine, who is an expert on grounded theory. She talks about what grounded theory is, what the interpretive process in grounded theory is, and what's so special about constructivist grounded theory.
Elaine, would you like to introduce yourself?
Hi, Sahel. Yes, absolutely. Thanks for having me. So, yes, I'm Associate Professor of Sociology of Education and Research Methods here in the School of Education at the University of Galway. I'm also Director of Doctoral Studies in the school. And as well as my work in Sociology of Education, I have a huge interest in research methods, particularly qualitative research methodologies. So for quite some time now, I have been very active with constructivist grounded theory. I had the privilege of working with Cathy Sharmaz over several years, and also with Robert Thornburg. So I'm delighted to be here to talk about all things grounded theory with you today.
Brilliant, thanks. I'm also delighted to and excited to be able to hear from you, because I'm not an expert in grounded theory. I've read about it and I've been taught about it, but I'm definitely not an expert. So for our listeners who also might be unfamiliar with grounded theory, could you provide a quick overview and explain its importance in terms of mental health and qualitative health research?
Sure. I suppose to start with its origins, it was developed in the 60s by sociologists Barney Glaser and Sam Strauss in the US. And they had come together to work on a study about dying in hospitals. And the research really was really successful. And as a result of that, they were asked a lot about the methods that they had used to do the project. And that really was how they came to write their book, The Discovery of Grounded Theory, in 1967. They came from very different backgrounds. So Strauss's work was grounded in Chicago School qualitative research. But Glaser's training actually had been very, very different. And he had been trained strongly in quantitative methods. But in spite of their differing traditions, they both emphasized a number of things in common as well, such as the importance of emergent concepts, comparative methods, and studying processes. So I suppose since its original development, grounded theory really has become probably the most used and certainly the most cited qualitative research methodology in the social sciences. And it aims to develop theory from data. So as opposed to the hypothetical-deductive model of research where, you know, we start with hypotheses, here we start with our empirical data. In grounded theory, data generation and analysis are very much intertwined. So we commence on analysis early, as soon as we have some data. And through theoretical sampling, which is a hallmark of grounded theory, we gather more data to fill emerging gaps in the analysis. So if you're doing a grounded theory study, that is a full grounded theory study, there are certain features of the methodology which really have to be present. These include having that iterative back and forth approach to data collection and analysis, early analysis with certain coding techniques like coding with gerunds, ing words to focus on action and process. The constant comparison approach, of course, theoretical sampling, memoing, which involves writing analytic notes. If they're not there, really, you can't say that it is a grounded theory study that has been conducted. Briefly then, just to bring the methodology up to the current times, after Glaser and Strauss's collaboration in the 60s, they and their work quite significantly diverged, in fact. So Glaser remained very committed to a particular version of grounded theory, often called the classical school, whereas Strauss further developed the method both alone and with another researcher called Juliet Corbin. Now, both of the schools have been increasingly criticized over the years because of what is seen as their objectivist underpinnings. And it is, of course, in that context that the constructivist school, led by Cathy Sharmaz, was born. So essentially, constructivist grounded theory is based still on the standard guidelines of traditional grounded theory, but there are some differences. So there's three key differences that we point out in terms of constructivist grounded theory relative to the original predecessors. The first is that in constructivist grounded theory, we do a literature review at the start of a study and throughout, okay? Whereas in the more classical approach, it's advised not to do any literature reviewing until you have completed your analysis. Now, my colleague Robert Thornburg has written a lot about this on informed grounded theory, in case anyone is interested in following up. The second key difference is that the role of the researcher is very much recognized in the constructivist approach. And this requires significant engagement by the researcher in processes of critical reflexivity right throughout the research. And considering the impact of essentially who we are and what we bring to the study on the data, on the construction of data, on the interpretation of data, and on the writing up of the study. And thirdly, then, in a constructivist approach, I've written quite a lot about those processes of critical reflexivity. And I've also written quite a bit about this third difference, which is about embedding a participatory element. And this is about creating ways to meaningfully involve participants in the grounded theory research process. So as I said, I have written quite a bit on that and about where we can develop opportunities for that to actually happen in a grounded theory study. And then finally, I suppose, just in terms of the importance of grounded theory in qualitative health research, Glaser, Strauss and Shermaz all started their methodological and substantive research from within the field of medical sociology. So there are extremely strong ties to qualitative health research and affinities with that field.
Thank you so much. That was a beautiful whistle-stop tour through grounded theory, and I appreciated also the history of it and to see how it was developed and who develops it. I think that's really important to understanding different methods and methodological approaches. I kind of wanted to pick up on something you said about constructivist grounded theory, that it is incorporating participatory approaches, it's got more of a reflexive element to it. So does that make it more, I guess, does that help it in terms of decolonizing agendas? I've definitely seen some papers looking at using constructivist grounded theory with indigenous methods, for instance. Does it enable us to perhaps take it from its grounded theory is moving from its historical context where, it was created, I guess, ultimately by two white men in a certain way, in a certain mindset, and a certain understanding of knowledge? And has constructive grounds theory now taken it more into perhaps the modern era? Would that be fair to posit?
I think so. What has been talked about a lot in terms of constructivist grounded theory is the turn towards social justice oriented research. So when you mention aspects of, you know, research related to, you know, decolonizing aspects, for example, of the curriculum, that is very much relevant. I mean, Kathy has emphasized this for quite some time, but it was something that we tried to develop further together. But she talked about constructivist grounded theory being particularly well suited to social justice research, for example, because essentially it does reject claims of objectivity. Also, the role of the researcher is absolutely recognized and taken into account through these critical reflexive processes. Not only that, but the researcher-participant relationship and creating rapport therein is very much emphasized and prioritized. And these are things that are not attended to at all. They're completely left aside in the more traditional grounded theory approaches. So certainly it would bring it up to date in those regards. Moreover, in grounded theory, we have something that we call sensitizing concepts. So these are important concepts from one's discipline that we know may be important, but we don't know if they really will be important in our study. And if they are important in our study, we don't know how they may be important or how they might apply. So, for example, in constructivist grounded theory, some of those sensitizing concepts that we would always have on our table to potentially draw upon, and I say potentially because we never paste on concepts in grounded theory. They always have to earn their way into the analysis. But we would always have a heightened awareness, if you like, of sensitizing concepts relating to power, privilege, equity, oppression, those sorts of concepts. We also, of course, in the constructivist approach, very much maintain a focus on context, on voice, which are also key concerns in social justice oriented research. And as I said, yes, including that participatory element, which is also sort of an ethical issue in a sense. My work in this area has been very much motivated by ethical concerns within social justice oriented research about researching with rather than, you know, on participants in accordance with best practice in that regard. So all of those kind of features of the constructivist approach are absent, if you like, in the more traditional grounded theory approaches. So certainly, to answer your question, yes, I suppose it does bring it much more up to date, particularly with social justice concerns.
Brilliant. Thank you so much for that. And I really appreciate you kind of going into the detail of the different elements of constructivist grounded theory. And the more you talk about it, the more it sounds like a very rewarding and fruitful process, but quite an intense one, especially from this perspective of interpretation, that there is a almost continual interpretation of data, of observations, of perspectives, of positionality. And it feels like quite a mammoth task, basically, to undertake. So what are the key challenges that researchers might face and experience when conducting and particularly interpreting data using grounded theory? I'm also thinking from a perspective of a lot of our listeners are students who might be interested in using grounded theory, but it sounds like it might take a lot of time and resources to do it properly. So what are the challenges? How do we overcome them?
Right. Well, I suppose before we get to the challenges, it might be worth just talking about, I suppose, the core philosophical difference between the schools, because it is important for anyone thinking about undertaking grounded theory, which school is it that I'm going to be following? So I might just talk about that briefly before I go into the challenges. So I suppose from a classical or Glaserian grounded theory perspective, what's interesting is that there's actually little or no interpretation of data. That's what's thought. So from the Glaserian or classical perspective, the idea is that patterns exist and are latent in social reality. They exist out there waiting to be discovered, in a sense. So the idea is if you employ grounded theory procedures appropriately, you will discover or uncover these patterns and be able to conceptualize them. So I suppose the role of the researcher then is regarded as being unproblematic. The researcher seems to be objective, detached and neutral. So there's no interpretation essentially involved from that perspective. Now, in Straussian grounded theory, there was always more nuanced statements, more complex understandings. But nonetheless, Straussian grounded theory, as well as Glaserian grounded theory, were both criticized as being overly objective, overly objectivist in nature. So I suppose it was in that context that, you know, that the critiques about the objectivism essentially, you know, came to the fore. And it was, you know, Kathy Sharmaz herself was a student both of Glaser and of Strauss. And she was a medical sociologist whose early work focused on the self in chronic illness. And she was very much influenced by interactionist theory, by pragmatist philosophy and so on. And she was really starting to focus on researcher subjectivity. She firmly believed that the kind of key grounded theory strategies could be kind of loosened from their positivist moorings and be used with a different epistemology. So it was from that basis that she started developing the philosophical underpinnings of constructivist grounded theory. When we come back then to, I suppose, the idea of interpretation from a constructivist perspective compared to the traditional approach in constructivist grounded theory, yes, we are very much involved in interpreting our data right throughout the research process. So, you know, we're looking at, you know, who's the researcher, what they bring to the table, preconceptions, impact of their sociodemographic positionality. And importantly, we put those knowledges on the table, so to speak, and we think about what's the impact on the research. The idea is that the researcher can't step outside themselves in analysing data. It's all interpretive, essentially. So when we think then of the common challenges, I'm not sure there are more challenges interpreting data in grounded theory than there are in other qualitative methodologies. But there are a lot of different stages, as you alluded to, in grounded theory. So there's a lot to do. Now, to be honest, anyone, I have had a lot of PhD students who have completed constructivist grounded theory studies. And they often think this feels like it's going to take an awful long time. And then suddenly they've come to nearly the end of their analysis quite quickly, because while you see, we start analysis very early on, it also means that the analysis is actually done sooner or completed sooner rather than, for example, doing 30 interviews and then having to do all of the analysis, if you like. But when I think through the challenges, there are a few definitely that come to mind. In grounded theory, we code with gerunds. Those are the verbal nouns. And we do that because it helps us to focus on action and process. And that is fundamental to GT. But it can feel quite odd at the start for beginning researchers to be trying to articulate codes that end in ing, if you like. When I think through other challenges, another problem I see actually with beginning GT researchers is not coding enough at the start. I'd always ask to see their transcripts. And frequently, there are far too few codes on the page. You know, in grounded theory, the first coding stage is coding line by line. And at the start of a study, your pages should be absolutely littered with codes, with one line of data from a transcript, sometimes producing multiple codes. And this is particularly the case at the beginning of a grounded theory study when we don't know what our study is about. Now, that might sound like an odd thing to say we don't know what our study is about, because yes, of course, in grounded theory, we do start off with a research question. We have a general substantive area. But in grounded theory, you see, it's very, very open and it's highly exploratory. So we're very much looking at all of our data to see where it leads us. And then in the later stages in constructivist grounded theory, we call the next stage of coding focused coding. This is where we identify the most frequent and or significant codes from our initial codes, and we bring those forward in some way. And these help us synthesize and summarize larger segments of data. And then at the next stage, we actually use those focused codes to begin and start grouping them together in different ways to begin to think about how we may develop provisional categories. Now, I always recommend continuing to use gerunds right throughout the coding and category development process, because this continues to help us to maintain that key focus in action and process, which is, as I've mentioned, at the very heart of all grounded theory endeavor. Another challenge I see is difficulties in higher level interpretation, thinking about what is really going on in this data set, you know, and how to conceptualize this.
Yeah, and actually it's a common issue, I think, across many different methods in qualitative health research. And we have another episode in this series with Shira, who talks about the difficulties in abstracting and supporting students to reach sort of higher conceptual levels. So it's a very relevant conversation. I just wanted to quickly ask and pick up on one of the things you said around identifying significant codes in your sort of analysis interpretation process. So aside from frequency, what makes for a significant code?
Well, it's one that's standing out to you in some way as the researcher, as being important, you know? It can be, certainly frequency is one indicator of significance, but it is not the only one. For example, obviously codes can be worded in different ways. Our participants can talk about the same things in different ways. So we may have something coming through that's quite significant in the data, but it's not necessarily frequent because perhaps it's being articulated by participants in different ways. But you can still see that there's something significant there, if you like. So really, it's part of the interpretive role, I suppose, of the grounded theorist, of the researcher, is to get a sense of what's significant. Now, that's easier said than done at the start of the study, to be honest. And that's why, you know, with my PhD students, what I would say is we do, you know, about 5 or 6 interviews first, sometimes fewer, 3 to 5 or 6 interviews first. We'll do, you know, we'll transcribe and code them between each one so that they can kind of feed into the development of the next. But then we will really do the very formal coding and analysis of that batch before doing any more. And we will get a sense of, you know, what's coming through here in terms of the key codes in the initial codes. And the initial codes, you're coding everything. You know, so you'll have hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of codes. And it's really only studying those codes that you start to see some elements of repetition and of significance. And you get a sense then of what is significant for these participants. in terms of their lived experiences and their perspectives. So I suppose interpretation of significance is something that develops with what we call in grounded theory, intimate familiarity with the study, with the participants, with the topic.
Great, thank you. So once you get to these focus codes and you're starting, I suppose, to think about your, I don't know, conceptual themes. Are there themes in grounded theory, or are they called something different?
Yeah, we prefer the word categories rather than themes. And, you know, partly that's to differentiate it from things like thematic analysis, where there are, you know, in thematic analysis, the focus is more on those kind of concrete topics and themes. And from a grounded theory perspective, we avoid that because they're seen as quite static. And remember, in grounded theory, the emphasis is on action and process.
Perfect. Okay. So the categories, how do you get to them? How do you make that conceptual leap?
Well, it's interesting. The conceptual leaps can happen at various different times. So it's not that there isn't a time schedule for when you will develop a kind of a conceptual thought about your data. And in fact, that reminds me to emphasize the key role of memoing in grounded theory. So memoing, I referred to earlier, it is essentially where you are writing analytic notes about your data. So, you know, Glaser's famous dictum is, no matter what you're doing, if you get an idea about your data, stop and memo. Now, a memo can be a few lines. Often at the beginning, you know, our memos are quite short. Sometimes they're quite descriptive. But over time, they do develop in terms of abstraction and levels of conceptualization. But the key point about memoing is that that memo writing is actually generative in terms of developing our conceptual analysis. It isn't just to record what we see happening in our codes or record what we see happening, you know, in provisional categories that we're developing. The very process of writing about our data really pushes us to conceptualize and actually to come up with some of these conceptual leaps, if you like. And during memoing, we often use what is called a type of abductive logic. So this type of logic is where we essentially hypothesize about something that might be not happening in our data. And then we go back and we check our data to ascertain, you know, which of these possibilities is the one that actually fits in terms of our data. Or do we need to gather more data to answer this potential question that we have raised? So, I mean, usually, now, when you've done these few interviews and you still have lots of these focus codes, the next stage is to start bringing them together and playing with your data to bring key ones together. There's that rule of internal homogeneity and external heterogeneity. Now, that sounds awful. I often think actually it sounds a bit like a medical procedure that you definitely don't want to undergo. But really what it means is bringing together things that are similar in some way. So you need to have a rule for bringing certain focus codes together. They need to relate to each other and you need to give them a title that encapsulates all of that similarity in a sense. And then in a different category, you're also bringing together things that are similar in some way. So they're internally homogeneous, essentially. But the categories are different from each other. So that's the externally heterogeneous bit. So that gives you the idea that there shouldn't be overlap between the categories. Now, of course, there always is at the start. And, you know, it's a very creative process, developing categories and splitting them and merging them and trying to get the best fit of your data so far for these provisional categories and properties that you have. And properties are bits of categories, so are different aspects of categories that you develop. Now, when we think then, because you asked about the kind of conceptual leap and where that happens and when it happens. So what I've tried to emphasize is there isn't a time when it happens. We are always thinking in our data what is going on here on a conceptual level. But certainly there is a time when we focus more on abstraction and conceptualization than others. And it's really at the focused and particularly the category and conceptualizing stage that we're engaging in increasing levels of abstraction as we go along. And I think it's a good question how we work towards abstraction, because of course, in grounded theory, this is the key defining characteristic, because what we're doing is we're developing a theory. It isn't a description we're trying to provide, it's a conceptualization. And in fact, this is one of the difficulties that we see time and time again in papers or theses that claim to have used grounded theory. And, you know, we see a lot of issues with the end result not really looking much like conceptualization. And sometimes the issue is that people are inadequately focused on actions and processes in their data and they get stuck in theme.
So are there particular kinds of questions you ask yourself during that process that help make that leap?
So Glaser says, you know, he gives us examples of lots of different questions that we should ask ourselves. So does Kathy Sharmaz, that help with abstracting our data. Things like, you know, what is this a study? What is this data a study of? What is this a grounded theory of? So we ask ourselves certain questions in our memos about our data and our codes. What are our participants doing? How are they doing it? Excuse me. Why are they doing it? And certainly Kathy has emphasized, you know, in trying to be more conceptual, that she says to us that one of the things we need to remember is that instead of viewing individuals like our participants as discrete units of analysis, instead of categorizing types of people, essentially, we need instead to focus on actions and processes. So kind of categorizing types of behavior, not people. And that actually helps us to work towards abstraction. But another tip I would have in that regard, and of course, this is commonly done in grounded theory, is the use of theoretical codes. They are, they're essentially sets of abstract logics. There are lots of different examples we could give you. In fact, Glaser identifies this as 17 or 18 families of theoretical codes. What do these mean and how we use them in our data? Is an important thing to think about. So like anything in grounded theory, right, whatever ones we use, they have to fit our data. They have to have earned their way into our analysis. So what I do in memos, for example, when I'm working with some of my data, is I try out some different theoretical codes to see how they fit. It's like I try them on. It's like going into a fitting room in a clothes shop and trying something on. How does it feel? You know, how does it fit? How does it look? We wouldn't just randomly choose an item of clothing without assessing its fit. It's the same with theoretical codes. So in my memos, I would try one on and write about what it looks like in my data and then specify it. So for example, one theoretical code or one family of theoretical codes that I've used quite a lot, this is because what has fit in a couple of my studies in particular are the six C's. Causes, context, contingencies, consequences, covariances, and conditions. And what I would do there is when I have, you know, some interesting codes, either initial codes or focus codes, whatever it is, or a category perhaps, and I'm writing about it in memos, trying to figure out its kind of internal coherence, if you like, and how different aspects of the category relate to each other, I might try on these theoretical codes. So one of the things that I would do when I'm looking at X, whatever X is in my memo, the thing I'm writing about, I will think about, okay, well, you know, what seems to have caused this? That's one of the six C's, causes, you know, or what's this thing's antecedent? What happened before it? Or what seems to be necessary for this thing to have happened? And then I look at the consequence. What seems to have happened as a result of this? So the consequence or the implication. And then, for example, conditions. Are there certain conditions that need to be in place for this thing to happen? So you can see you ask yourself questions in your memos about this, but you don't just make up answers. You may know the answer from your head, from all the analysis that you've done from your data, but frequently you have to go back and check your data to see, oh, okay, no, that's the condition. Was that the case for most of the participants? Sometimes then you might be missing data. And that allows us then through theoretical sampling to go and gather more data. And you see, it's through those sorts of writing processes and engaging with theoretical codes that helps us to raise the conceptual level. Because suddenly then we have a kind of a core concept, perhaps, that we're writing about. And we've identified its antecedents, perhaps, and also its consequences or implications, and perhaps its conditions. And then we're starting to write and to think on a much more abstract and conceptual level about the point of interest than just describing the thing, if you like, and participants' views about the thing. So And the only other thing I'd say about that in terms of conceptualizing is that a wonderful aid to developing our conceptual analyses and our thinking in this regard is, of course, the use of diagramming. Now, Kathy Sharmaz talks about this a lot in her publications. And diagramming, and you don't need to be good at art, by the way, for this. I'm appalling at art, but I enjoy diagramming very much. I use a lot of arrows. So I might, you know, put a circle around the core thing that I'm looking at in a memo. And I'd often do this diagramming in memos, you know. I'd put a circle around something that I'm focusing on, and I'd put an arrow, you know, before it to kind of indicate the sequence of what's happening in my data. Maybe an arrow after it to show that kind of the implication or the consequence. So I would use arrows a lot and circles a lot to kind of capture and trace and chart what's happening in my data and the relationships between aspects of my analysis. And I find that really useful. And again, it's to approach it in a playful way. You know, I often sketch things out to see, is this what I'm thinking is happening? And then I go back and check my data and I go, no, that's not it. Scrap it, you know. So yeah, they would be kind of the key things that I would focus on and encourage my students to do in trying to raise the conceptual level of their data. Now, I will say, there's definitely something to be said about going for a walk. And I know that sounds strange, but, you know, you can, it's like anything, you can be working at something and you can be trying to force it far too much. Often what you need is time and space. You can be very embedded in your data and, you know, working with theoretical codes and you're seeing some connections, but, you know, there's something that's not quite coming together. And often it's when that's when you walk the dog or you go and meet a friend or you do something different. And this, I think, is true for all aspects of research. Your mind has been working on it in the background. And it's often in those circumstances that I've gotten, I won't say it's a flash of inspiration, but a sense of actually what they're talking about here is whatever.
I'm just conscious of our time. And I really appreciate your description of how we get from sort of more descriptive codes to these abstract and conceptual categories, because I think that's something that is often not particularly written about in published papers and not so much talked about in qualitative health research. And this is partly what our series is hoping to do, to reveal what actually happens in that process. But I kind of wanted to just ends by asking, you know, is there one or two key things, key resources that you say this is the one you need to go to get a basic understanding of how to do constructivist ground of theory in particular?
Sure. And you're right. These things are not talked about very much at all. But yeah, for anyone thinking of embarking on a constructivist grounded theory journey, I would definitely say to go to Kathy's 2014 book, Constructing Grounded Theory. Because not only does she talk about the development and history of grounded theory, its philosophical basis, all of that, but she also presents a whole range of worked examples from different constructivist grounded theorists in the field across numerous disciplines. So I think people would find that very, very useful. I mean, I think you need to read the classics, to be honest. People are always amazed that you're sending me to read Glaser and Strauss, but I wanted to do Kathy's constructivist grounded theory. Again, to emphasize, Kathy's constructivist grounded theory builds on, you know, the classical work. I always tell people, read Glaser and Strauss's The Discovery of Grounded Theory, the 1967 book, you know. And some of the writing can be a little bit difficult to get your head around. But I always encourage people to read Glaser's book on theoretical sensitivity. It's his 1978 book, would you believe? Finally, I think probably the one that I would recommend is Morse et al.'s 2021 book, Developing Grounded Theory, The Second Generation Revisited. So that is written by all of the original students of Glaser and Strauss, including Janice Morse, Juliet Corbin, Kathy Sharmaz and others, who each give examples of how to do their version of grounded theory. And they talk about key developments in the field. And of course, I have to end by recommending the book that I'm doing with Robert at the moment. It'll be out next year. It's the Routledge International Handbook on Constructivist Grounded Theory in Educational Research.
Beautiful. Thank you so much. What an extensive list of great things to get stuck into, and brilliant to good to start with the classics. So I just want to say from my perspective and from our listeners' perspective, thank you so much for your time. Thank you so much for your in-depth responses. And hopefully we will be reading your excellent book come next year.
Very welcome. A pleasure.